Welcome, everyone, to this very special edition podcast series on the 2020 Bitcoin halving, brought to you by our friends at Bitstamp, the original global cryptocurrency exchange. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors everywhere, trusted by over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools available on web and mobile. Join 4 million traders and download the Bitstamp app from the App Store or Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro. And for Bitstamp users, we've got a special. Ansari is now offering 25% off Ansari Pro, our professional-grade crypto analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help you identify your next investments. Head over to Ansari.io and use the offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. That's Ansari.io, offer code Bitstamp. With that, let's dive right in. This episode's going to be a good one. All right, everyone. Welcome back to Ansari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2-Bit Idiot from the Citadel. Again, got a very special guest today as part of our special series on the Bitcoin halving. Talking to co-founder and CEO of BTC China, and more recently, the founder and CEO of Ballet, which is a physical storage company focused on crypto security and secure storage. Bobby is one of the first people I met in the industry. There's a consistent theme with this series of episodes in that pretty much everybody that I've been speaking to, I met for the first time in Las Vegas in 2013, which was the first Bitcoin bubble.
It was December 2013.
Right after China banned Bitcoin for the first time of many. I'm putting, you know, quotes around that. But this was about a year after the first halving. Bobby, you know, obviously been an early adopter and major player in bridging the east-west divide of the community in some respects, and had a phenomenal run with BTC China. We're going to talk a little bit about that, his history, and get into what he's been working on recently, with a colorful bit of commentary in the middle surrounding all the halvings. But Bobby, for starters, for those that aren't familiar with you, your background, maybe just a quick discussion of how you got into the industry, what you did before crypto, and how we got to this point today.
Sure. So I've been in tech. I started my career in at Yahoo. So mm-hmm. There's internet back in late 90s, like 1998. I studied computer science at Stanford. So I've always been, you know, math and science kind of guy in tech. And then I got into Bitcoin in early 2011, in the first half of 2011. And my brother, of course, Charlie, he introduced me to Bitcoin. That's when he started mining it. And I started mining soon after that summer. So it's, you know, it's been 9 years. Time has flown by really fast. And I, at the time I was a hobbyist, you know, mining Bitcoin. I was living in Shanghai in China. And I was working at Walmart, e-commerce in China, head of their technology department for the e-commerce side. And then I got into full-time Bitcoin in 2013. That's when I got together with my two co-founders and started BTC China, the very first Bitcoin exchange in China. We got funding that year. And then, of course, the FOMO, you know, became the Bitcoin itself peaked. Actually peaked twice in 2013. Many people didn't know that. The first peak was actually in April of 2013. And then the second bigger peak was in November, mm-hmm. when it went to $1,200. Mm-hmm. And we, at that time, we actually became the world's largest exchange by trading volume, surpassing Mt. Gox. So those were the fun days.
Let's you ran that business, which had two components, two different sides between the exchange and the mining pool that were definitively impacted by the first halving. So let's talk about late 2012, leading up to that first halving, which really was, it was kind of a novelty at the time because the stakes were still so low just in terms of total market value, but you were still one of the largest centralized entities giving people access to this. And in particular, you know, interfacing with the Chinese investor cohorts and then the actual mining community, which is going to be most impacted by this slashing in rewards. At that point, what was the sentiment around the halving, if anything, or was this more just a narrative cycle that was good marketing for the industry to actually have hit this milestone and gotten from, you know, zero to something that wasn't necessarily going away within the first 4 years?
Yeah. So just to clarify, during the first halving, 2012, it was November 2012, I was actually on the sideline just as an amateur. I wasn't in it full time yet. So I didn't join BTC China until early spring of 2013.
Okay.
So that coincided with the run up, because if you remember the first halving in November 2012, the price was, you know, $1, $2. You know, it was like under $10 for a long while. Mm-hmm. And the price actually didn't budge right around the halving or right after. It was probably 3, 4, 6 months later, starting February of 13, February, March, April. That's when it really ran up and then really surpassed the previous high, which was like $20 some. So I recall distinctly, you know, 2013. Again, this is 2 years after I got into it, right? I was in China. My brother Charlie was in California. I recall distinctly messaging him, you know, sending text messages. Oh my gosh, Bitcoin's going to cross $10, $20. It's going to all reach all time high. You know, so those were, I wish I had saved those text messages, but those are fun. Yeah.
And when did you get into the mining pool business? Was that later? That was something
later. That happened. So BTC China started as an exchange first. It was launched in June of 2011 by my two co-founders. And then I joined in 2013, and that's when we start turning into company, raise venture financing and all that. For the rest of 2013, it was just FOMO, you know, price rise and all that. And of course it came crashing down from $1,200 down to $800, down to $500. That was right around early 2014, and also coincided with the collapse of MT. Gox. So that was a big industry shaking moment at the time. In the summer of 2014, that's when we launched the BTCC pool, the mining pool business. So we eventually had three or four businesses, but we started with an exchange, had a mining pool. We launched a wallet, a web wallet called Picasso at first. And then later we renamed it JustPay. And then we also had a mobile wallet called Mobi. Mm-hmm. And of course we launched the physical Bitcoins collection called BTCC Mint. That was in 2016. But the mining pool, you know, we ran that pretty well from 2014 till we sold the company. I sold the company in 2018.
Yep. So that was really, I'd say, the height of euphoria, the depths of despair, and then the slope of enlightenment, and then you kind of got out right after the second big bubble. Help people understand. What got you excited to go full time in early 2013? When, you know, yes, there was some infrastructure that had been spun up, but there really, you know, Mt. Gox was the only game in town. It was, you know, there wasn't really any VC investments. You could have fit all of the entrepreneurs around one table in spring of 2013. And in fact, some people did. And if you kind of remember the you know, get togethers in New York and San Francisco and
that's right,
elsewhere around that time. What made you flip the switch
from just casual observer to
hardcore industrialist?
It was a little bit of circumstances and a little bit of also pre-planning. I remember distinctly in summer of 2011, after I had discovered Bitcoin. At the time, I had a very good full-time role at Walmart doing e-commerce for China. And I recall talking to a VC, a good venture capitalist friend, and I was telling him about Bitcoin. And I said to myself in front of him, I said, you know, if I've ever, at the time, by the way, I was a corporate guy, right? I was working at, you know, Walmart, I worked at Yahoo, worked at EMC. So I've been a corporate big company kind of guy. I've never done a startup in real sense. But I did say to him distinctly, I said, hey, if I ever jump out and do a startup, I'll do it in Bitcoin. And this is in the summer of 2011. And the reason at the time, because Bitcoin was really fascinating, right? That notion of digital money, digital asset. It was likened to digital gold. I've always been a fan of gold, decentralized, you know, asset. So I said, you know, if I ever do a startup, I'll do it in Bitcoin. And then of course, you know, 2 years came to pass, 2.5 years came to pass. I left Walmart, actually, not even 2 years. It was 1.5 years went by. I left Walmart at the end of 2011. Sorry, at the end of 2012, and then I was looking for a next role for a new company to join. At the time, you know, the default would be to go join another company, a large company, tech company, either in Shanghai, Beijing, or come back to Silicon Valley. And then I was talking to my wife and said, you know what? I could actually do a startup. And if I did a startup, as I promised myself, I'll do it in Bitcoin. So that's when I decided to connect with my two co-founders who had already launched the BTC China website. And we got together, agreed to go forward. You know, I was going to take on the CEO role, and also to raise financing as a startup. So we were the very, very first company in all of Asia to get venture financing. We got it from Lightspeed China. Mm-hmm. So the rest is history. So we, like you said, it was back then, early 2013, there were just a handful of entrepreneurs in this ecosystem.
Wild ride after that. Mt. Gox fails in February of 2014. From February 2014 to January 2015, it's pretty much a straight shot down with a couple of dead cat bounces in the middle. And then all of 2015 is basically just apathy, sideways trading, no volatility. So it's kind of the best of all worlds because the holders were kind of losing interest. But maybe as or more importantly, all of the infrastructure companies were bleeding out because there was no volatility.
Correct.
and so there was no trading fees. And so there was no, you know, kind of ongoing revenue to support all this infrastructure that was getting built out. And no subsequent venture investment because it just looked like something that people had forgotten about. We're talking to Dan Matuszewski from Circle in the first episode of the series, he made a very good point that the 2016 halving was kind of like the event that everybody rallied around. It was like the life raft, right?
Yeah,
everything had gone to shit in like 2014, 2015. And it was just this like, you know, kind of bumpy ride between 200 and 400 after the highs of, you know, 1,000.
1,200,
and for someone for someone like you that got in when it was 10 and 20 and you know, getting excited when it hit those milestones, that's still a pretty big run up. But people, I think, fail to appreciate there weren't moments like Andreessen Horowitz raising a $500 million crypto fund in like that bear market. Right? It was
correct.
Everybody was kind of running low. Is there truth to that, right? Or what helped kind of turn the ship back around, in your opinion, between late 2015 and early 2016?
Well, what do you mean by turn the ship around? You mean
just get people excited again and.
I think for good and bad, a lot of the crypto, and I guess it's more of the bad. You and I are longtime hodlers. We talked about this earlier. You know, we're strong hodlers. I think the weak hodlers sold out their position in 2015. Some really got panicked, sold out in 2014 during the bear market, during the crash. And then, of course, during the bear market, 15 and early 16, you know, a lot of people thought, hey, it was pointless to hold on to Bitcoin. It's just not performing, right? So we saw a lot of people sell out. Of course, I personally didn't, and I had long-term faith in Bitcoin. That's also when we launched the first BTCC mint business with the one Bitcoin titanium physical coin. Mm-hmm. And then we launched that business before the halving, and of course, after the halving, we continued to sell, including making poker chips. So 2016 was a very special year for me because we launched that very fun business, physical Bitcoin. We sent them out as gifts. We sold them over online. And of course, the halving came and went, but the price didn't really. So in my experience, you know, two times now, the halving, people anticipate halving. They're excited for the price increase, but the reality is, the halving doesn't increase the price right away. So it's usually the effects of the price increase affecting the stock flow, the lower quantity of Bitcoin being mined. That takes effect 3 to 6 months later. So it wasn't, and funnily, it coincided with Trump's election. So that's when the full, and sorry, my headset keeps falling out. So I remember it was, I think it was October, November. That's when, when it crossed $500 again, you know, $500, you know, at the time, it was like, oh my gosh, the magic number, we're going to be at $600, $700. So that's when we crossed over that. And of course, we know that by the end of 2016, by early 2017, we reached $1,000. That was a huge, huge milestone. So that would be the equivalent of reaching, you know, $15,000-$20,000 in today's memory.
Yep.
Yeah. So my point is that I think the price increase is what brings back the market. I don't think the market did anything different to warrant the price increase. I don't think it's the ecosystem or the companies mm-hmm. that sort of artificially inflated the market, but rather the market came around, and then the market is a lagging indicator of the supply of Bitcoin. This is the stock to flow theory, mm-hmm. the market prices, and then of course the sentiment of the industry is a lagging indicator of the market prices as well. Mm-hmm. So by the time when your taxi driver and the Starbucks barista tells you about Bitcoin, that's when you know it's peaked, even though they think they just got in.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Did you have concerns going into the halving around the health of the mining pool? Help people understand from a pool operator's perspective what some of the concerns were, just for the functionality of the network. And you can probably make an educated guess that this time around, not going to be dissimilar from last time, where you see a temporary dip with some capacity falling off, but otherwise things correct, the next generation miners come on board, and then the difficulty gradually starts ticking back up in subsequent months and quarters. Is, you know, from a pool operator standpoint, you must have some insights into the type of machines that are being used, expectations around what capacity would fall off, and how that would impact pool performance. Did your internal forecasts around that time, were they pretty close to the reality of what actually happened post-halving in terms of capacity, or was there anything that surprised you or took you off guard?
Yeah, we actually, you know, we operated the pool again from 14 to end of to early 2018. So about 3 years through the halving of the
through that second halving.
Mm-hmm. Through that second halving. We didn't do any formal forecasts for hash power and stuff like that. We just maintained a market share between 15% and 25-30% of the global mm-hmm. global hash rate. Of course that number varied over the years, and then basically before the halving, after the halving, our hash power, I think, I don't have notes from that, but if I recall correctly, it wasn't more than 10, 15, 20%. So the halving is not as detrimental as people worry for the worse. This time around, I don't think it's going to be the case either. I think what we see is we've seen a lot of hash power come in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, some hash power will drop off. That's to be expected, but it's going to be at most 10, 15, 20%, 25%. It's not going to be like a dramatic fall off. Yeah. And also don't forget, as the price increases in anticipation of the halving, we saw that, right? Just barely a few weeks ago, a month ago, it was like it bottomed out at $3,000, $4,000. Now it's at $9,000. So it's more than half of where it bottomed out at. Mm-hmm. So that really helps as well. So the higher the price, the more it can sustain in terms of hash power going into and after the halving.
And miners, you can think of as pro-cyclical, where they're only selling as much as they need to in order to make ends meet and ensure that they're covering their overhead. But otherwise, you know, the margin, at the margin, they're net longs for the ecosystem and probably not selling everything that they're
making. Correct. Yeah. And they many of them even lend out their Bitcoins mm-hmm. and get cash with Bitcoins on collateral. They get cash to buy and finance the equipment as well as the facilities, the hosting costs, and the electricity payments. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them do that, which is fine. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your experience operating in China and in Asia in particular. There's obviously a different set of rules that you have to play by, and the relationships that you need to have, whether you're talking about New York regulators or the CCP authorities that are ultimately, you know, gonna want to know exactly what you're doing. They're not that different in with respect to oversight, but culturally there's you know, kind of worlds of difference between how the two environments function in practice. What are What are some of the kind of unspoken rules of operating in that environment, particularly in a frontier asset class like Bitcoin, where, you know, the CCP has been very outspoken that they don't want investors getting hurt and they want to make sure that this is shunned, but at the end of the day, they don't really seem to care or want to involve themselves, I guess, because it's more of a distraction than anything. And at this point, because mining capacity is largely in China, it's something that they can be a little bit more flexible about, because they basically they hold all the chips, right? Figuratively and literally.
Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned the word asset class. Of course, you and I know, everyone's listening, all the industry people know that Bitcoin is indeed a new asset class, digital asset class. But funny thing is China, the government, they sort of are in denial. They either don't want to or they truly don't believe it is a new asset class. So they're denying that it's an asset class, much like they classify Bitcoin almost like you would categorize like email addresses and digital photographs. Right? Think about email addresses and photographs. We all have email accounts. Oh, that email address belongs to me. You know, these are the photos I took on my iPhone. They're uploaded to cloud. Those are my photos. I could share them with you. I could, you know, all that stuff. So they almost treat Bitcoin kind of like that, like those digital goods. Okay, whether it's an email account or a digital photograph or those swords and, you know, shields in World of Warcraft online games. So it's almost classified like that, digital property. So that's better, digital property, but they refuse to make a official ruling to call it an investable asset class. And again, the reason is that the public reason is they don't want people to lose money by buying these phantom digital assets, you know, quote unquote. They want an orderly society. They want peace, tranquility, and, you know, stable economy and stuff like that. So that's the reason they don't want people to be over invested in cryptocurrency and tokens and so on. Now, of course, over the years, we've seen the rise of shitcoins, you know, tokens and all that. And we really saw, you know, we really see how bad it can get, right? When people are, you know, swindling, when these promoters are swindling casual investors' money in loading up these, you know, worthless shit coins, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you and I, being strong Bitcoin believers, we understand the concept of shit coins being worthless. You know, so it's funny how the way they, meaning the regulators, the Chinese government, the central bankers, the way they see Bitcoin is how you and I see the shit coins.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like they really don't like it. They really don't like it. So they don't even want to give it a name, a label, and that's why they put up all these regulations, or the quote unquote regulations, and these so-called fake bannings, multiple bannings of Bitcoin over the years. So it's really how that is. And then historically, just to review, they first banned Bitcoin in December of 2013. Mm-hmm. And then it was quiet. You know, the price went down. They're happy. When the price goes down, they're happy, right? Because then it's not on anyone's radar. You know, grandmas are not losing the money on Bitcoin because they've already banned it. It's when Bitcoin came back up again in 2016, early 17. That's when we got the second phone call. By the way, all these throughout those 3 years, we're waiting. We're begging them, hey, please come regulate us. Please give us a license. Tell us what to do, how to do KYC, AML, what are your requirements, what's compliance, you know, what are the compliance requirements. But they would give us no attention at all. But of course, they came knocking again in January 2017. That's when they said, oh, you know, this thing, Bitcoin thing, you guys made the price go up to $1,000. Let's squash it back down.
Mm-hmm.
And as if they're asking us to bring the price back down, as if like we had some control over it. We're like, I'm flabbergasted. Like, hello, this is not like a centralized exchange, I could just adjust the price, right? It's not like an order book, I could just adjust the price. So, and literally the people who came to talk to us in January 2017, they had instructions from their boss to come tell us to move the price back down. So, you know, it was funny. It was just hilarious. We have to educate them like, how, you know, this is not just my exchange, it's a global network of exchanges. They all run 24/7. I can't control the prices, you know, any better than anyone else can. Of course, I'm talking to Communist Party people who are known to be market manipulators and market, they control prices, right? You know, of commodities, right? In the real world.
And the great irony is that it took until the end of the year for the CFTC in the US to finally approve futures. And part of their stated reason was we got to curb the excesses of this bubble and give people a way to go short. And so you want to talk about market manipulation. You know, you got a private visit, but there was this public pronouncement and regulatory approval, which was important, but it was more important to curb the runaway freight train in 2017 than it was to allow for, you know, additional speculation.
Yeah, I'll share a tidbit about early. Would you like to hear more about the regulation stuff in China?
Yeah, please.
So I'll share a tidbit. Not many people know about this. It wasn't well recorded in history. But starting in March, to appease the regulators, we actually collectively, the three big exchanges, started an effort where we stopped allowing Bitcoin withdrawals. So you could trade on an exchange. I think you could deposit. You could deposit, but you can't withdraw. So it's this weird dichotomy where you could put in cash, you could take out cash, you could put in Bitcoin, but you can't withdraw. And the mm-hmm. outcome is that the prices would be artificially lower on our exchange than on the outside exchange where there's free flow. So that happened, that stayed on for about 3 months. So we had a suppressed pricing. And again, the suppression wasn't a suppression that we did on purpose. It was that we had to disallow withdrawals to appease regulators. But in effect, the prices appeared to be lower on the exchange. And that happened for about 3 months. And finally, we gave up, like, this is not working. And so by June, the prices popped back into the global prices. And that's when we had the FOMO for the ICOs. That summer of 2017 was the ICO summer boom. And, you know, and then the third time they came by was in August, September of 2017. That's when they asked all the exchanges to close down. So that was the final shoe, if you will.
Thanks to our sponsor, Bitstamp, for making this special halving series possible. Bitstamp's the original global crypto exchange. We're proud to be celebrating their third Bitcoin halving. Doesn't get much more OG than that. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors worldwide, with over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. They've got some serious trading tech, matching engine from NASDAQ, the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. So you can join the 4 million traders on Bitstamp by downloading their app, the App Store or Google Play, or go to bitstamp.net/pro to get started. And a reminder for Bitstamp users, Messari is now offering 25% off of Messari Pro, our professional analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help identify your next investments using promo code Bitstamp. That's Messari.io, offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve.
And of course, I mean, there is still exchange activity in the mainland, unofficially or officially.
Unofficially.
Yeah, I mean, but Wobi and OKX have massive offices outside of Beijing. So what is the reality of both, you know, how you would incorporate an exchange, what the rules of the game are, and you know, do you have like CCP members that are in your Monday morning meetings and just basically keeping tabs on things, even if the legal incorporation is technically in Hong Kong? What has been the evolving relationship that the regulators have with the professional exchanges, right? Let's leave the crap aside. But for those giants where we know that significant global liquidity still rests there, you know that there's significant real volume, you know that the market is real, but it's in this kind of weird gray area where it's not sanctioned, but it's also not been totally legalized.
Right. So those are the two large exchanges, OKCoin and Huobi, and there's also Binance, of course. So these three, I believe they all have offices in mainland China, but they're categorized as, you know, software development offices and also customer service, customer care, customer service centers. The business operations are technically and legally in a different jurisdiction. So they don't have any licenses in China to operate the business, and they operate on their website in a foreign country, whether it's Hong Kong, the United Kingdom, you know, US or whatever, all these different countries. Malta and stuff like that. However, so for the Chinese people to get access to that service, they have to use a VPN because China has a controlled internet. So all the sanctions, all the websites that are easily accessible in China have to be sanctioned by the Chinese government. If you're not sanctioned, you're blacklisted. Literally, no one can get access to your website. All the packets are dropped. There's no DNS resolution and so on. So you have to use a VPN to get access to those. So of course there are many, many exchanges aside from those top three. There are many exchanges that cater to the Chinese market, a lot of smaller ones, And then they cater to the Chinese market by offering their website service and mobile apps in the Chinese language. They offer rudimentary deposit services in China, sort of under the radar.